Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is Morteza Hajizadeh, your host from Critical Theory Channel. And today I'm honored to have Dr. Philip Nell with us. Dr. Philip Nell is a distinguished professor of English at Kansas State University. He's a scholar of children's literature and comics. He's the author or co-editor of 13 books and over 50 articles. And today he's here to talk to us about a wonderful book he wrote in 2017, but I guess the book has been revised. The book is called Was the Cat in the Hat Black? The Hidden Racism of Children's Literature and the Need for Diverse Books, published by Oxford University Press in 2017. Philip, welcome to New Books Network.
Thanks for having me.
Can you, Philip, tell us a little about yourself? You're a professor of literature, how you became interested in literature, and how you became interested in this particular area, which is racism in children's literature.
Sure. Children's books are the books that we read when we are the most impressionable, and so they stand to make a much longer lasting impression on the adults we become. So that's one reason that I'm interested in children's books. Because they have an outsized impact on the adult self, on what we believe, on who we see as fully human, on our sense of whose stories matter enough to be told in a book at all. And I guess, personally, how did I come to be interested in the field and in racism in particular? The field would be because, children's books are what made me a reader and ultimately the kind of quirky individual who would decide to get a PhD in English. But the racism part, I think it comes very much from my own upbringing as a white American of South African parents, one of whom is fairly actively racist. So I think it's partly a response to that. It's something that as a white person, I have to constantly make myself aware of. But I think one of the best places to make yourself aware is in children's books and in, the beginnings of the formation of the self. And so that's why I think children's books are one of the best places to oppose racism and all the isms, all the different kinds of ways that people can be othered or oppressed. We learn this from the culture. So start while you're young.
And let's talk about the title of this book. What does it refer to? Was the cat in the hat black? What does it refer to?
Well, it's a riff on Shelley Fisher Fiskin's book, Was Huck Black?, in which she talks about the African-American origins of Mark Twain's famous book and character, Huckleberry Finn. And her point is that, in the U.S., at least, histories of literature tend to be very segregated. White authors influence white ones and black influences black ones, but that's not really true. Everybody influences everybody, and she wants to desegregate that. And that's also true, I think, of American children's literature. And so that's why I was riffing on her title, because that's a problem. As a nonsense poet, Sue certainly has white ancestors like Lewis Carroll or Edward Lear. And, you know, even as someone who, in some of his work, tries to oppose stereotypes, has ancestors who are both white and black. But he's also heir to illustrators and authors who perpetuate racist stereotypes. He's a complicated figure. And that's really true of anybody who's writing. You know, we're all influenced by all kinds of ideas. Some of them are beautiful and some of them toxic. And that peculiar combination is where the art comes from. And you have to reckon with all of it, I think. And so that's, the book is an attempt to reckon with all of it, if you will. Yeah.
So in this book, how does children's literature conceal its own racialized origin? And in this particular case, you talk about blackface caricature and also the racial complexity of the cat.
Yeah, I mean, you know, starting in childhood, we absorb racist images and ideas without our knowledge and without our consent. And that is also true of the people who make the books. I don't think Dr. Seuss is intentionally recycling racist caricature in his books, but he is, you know, quite explicitly in some books where he has, for example, in If I Ran the Zoo, the main character goes to the African island of Yerka, and there he draws these really racist caricatures of African people. In the same book, the main character in search of animals for his zoo goes to the mountains of Zambamatant with helpers who all wear their eyes at a slant, and he draws these slant-eyed human characters as well. But, you know, he also does work that's sort of anti-racist, or aspires to be. Books like Horton Hears a Who, where size is an arbitrary marker of difference, you know, a person's a person no matter how small, or this Nietzsche's, which was inspired by his opposition to anti-Semitism. The cat is somewhere in between. He's not overtly racist caricature, but nor could we sort of say he's with the anti-racist strain in Seuss. He is inspired by, among other things, blackface minstrelsy, which is not strange. There's a lot of characters in popular culture who are inspired by blackface minstrelsy, the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz, Bugs Bunny, Mickey Mouse. It was a very popular form of entertainment, and it shows up all over the place. Sometimes in more coded ways, like the white gloves of Mickey Mouse, or the Cat in the Hat, or of Bugs Bunny, or the ridiculous headgear of the Cat in the Hat, but it's there. And so but the cat then is also inspired by a Crazy Cat, the creation of the African American cartoonist George Harriman, who himself is a fascinating subject because he spent most of his life passing as a white man. But some of his thoughts on race do emerge in the cartoons. And then the cat is also inspired by an actual person, an African American elevator operator named Annie Williams, who Seuss would see when he went on the elevator up to visit William Spalding at Houghton Mifflin. And William Spalding was the editor who invited him to write a book to help children learn to read, and that book was The Cat in the Hat. So the cat is racially complicated, and that's why the title of the book is a question. I don't know. And what would it mean to assign a racial category to this cat? So it is genuinely a question. I think we need to think about how popular culture recycles racist stereotypes, and I think there's a way in which, and I should have said this in the book itself, but there's a way in which these sort of more subtle versions of caricature prepare us to accept more overt versions of it. But then at the same time, is the Cat in the Hat black? And what would it mean to call him black? You know, what does it mean that he has this sort of array of influences from an actual human woman to a stereotype? It's racism is more complicated than I think most people are willing to consider. So that's also why that's the title of the book.
More recently, there has been a lot of discussion about this cancel culture. I think a couple of years ago, I read somewhere, I live in Australia, and I read that there was this teacher who was reading Huckleberry Finn in a high school in New Zealand, and she came over the N-word, she read the word, but of course she was just reading a part of the novel. And a student complained again about her. She was given a harsh warning or something like that. So some people go to some kind of an extreme, you know, to cancel all these books, even Mark Twain, who of course was against slavery. So my question is, do you agree with canceling classic books mainly that depict racist stereotypes, but from a sympathetic point of view? I mean, sympathetic in terms of being anti-racist.
Well, I don't think that The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is anti-racist. I think it's taught that way. It was certainly taught to me that way. I remember learning that about the book when I was growing up, but, you know, it's about Huck's crisis of conscience. You know, he's certainly depicted as less racist than his pap. I think that's fair to say. But there's also the character of Uncle Silas, who owns human beings, who's presented quite kindly. And for the last third of the book, Jim is just a plaything. It's a big joke, you know. If there's any anti-slavery sentiment in it, in the first two-thirds of it, that's completely undercut in that last third of it. And also, I mean, the book was written a generation after the end of slavery. So I don't really think it's all that radical to make the suggestion that black people are human. And it is a mere suggestion. You know, the liberal use of the N-word in Huckleberry Finn over 200 times, that's not there to call attention to why that's not a good word to use. That's not there in the way that it is in County Collins' poem Incident. That's just a noun. And Twain doesn't really undercut that. And that has always been a very toxic and hurtful word to use. It was in 1884 when the book was published. You know, it was in pre-abolition period, pre-Civil War period, when the book takes place. You know, Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, from 1852, a racist character uses the N-word, and an anti-racist character punches him for it. You know, it's like literally a fighting word. So I don't think the book is anti-racist. I think a lot of us are taught that. Jonathan Rack has a whole book on this subject, which I would recommend, but it's not. And then as for canceling, I don't see any evidence that it's been canceled. I mean, you can still get it, you can still read it, it's still out there. So I don't actually see it as canceled at all, because it's available and because it's really hard to cancel a dominant culture. You know, a minoritized culture, much easier to cancel, right? You know, about half of the 300 indigenous languages that were once spoken in the United States are now speaking today. Those are gone, right? Because colonization and genocide and forced assimilation, pretty good at canceling culture. Really remarkably effective, but I don't see any evidence of that kind of erasure happening with Mark Twain or Dr. Seuss. There are certainly people raising questions about them, as they should, but the books are still out there. So,
there might be like incidents, let's say separate incidents, but the media kind of, you know, blows it out of proportion and
The people, at least in the States, who kind of perpetuate this myth of cancel culture, they're the very people who are right now removing multicultural children's books and books that address racism in an honest way from schools. So they are actually canceling culture, or they're trying to. As a term, it's a lie. It is possible to cancel a culture, but that's not the way it's being used. If the question is sort of more about like what do we do with these books? That's a really good question, right? They are important, we have to do something with them. I think one thing you can do with them is to read them critically. You know, another thing you can do with them is to stop reading them. Also read them in context. You know, you can read against them. There's a lot of things you can do with problematic or racist or sexist children's books. And none of those are, you know, setting them on fire, right? Because even if you decide not to read it or decide not to publish it, right? Come on. Like the Seuss books that they stopped publishing a few years ago, they're still around, you know? Huck Finn's still around. Still there. Not going anywhere.
And the question of how to engage with these books, I really love this part of your book, and I'm going to quote from that section. It would be great if we could talk about it. So it's about how teachers or children should engage with this, should engage with these texts effectively. And you talk about submerged anger and express anger. So I'll just read that quote, which is on page 104. A critical examination of these books, while readers are still children, might prevent youthful affection from curdling into adult nostalgia. Grown-ups' affective relationship with the works of their childhood often clouds their perception.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, as Walter Benjamin once observed, children's culture evokes what is both cherished and lost, and that combination can make us reactionary. You know, when you point out racism in a beloved childhood book or movie or game, you know, an adult can feel personally attacked. And I get that, right? Because children's books and toys and culture are signposts not just to our childhoods, but to this, to the formation of ourself, you know, to who we actually are. And so when somebody attacks that, it can really feel like you're being attacked. It can feel like kind of violation, because something that you love, something that you cherish, is being attacked, and so by implication, so are you. So I see why people feel that way. You know, and that's why I think it would be really helpful to raise these questions earlier with children, when their emotional relationships are still in the process of forming. You know, they're still open-ended. I mean, we all should develop more complicated relationships with these books, but I think it's easier to develop those complicated relationships when you're young. I think it's understandable that adults are going to find this harder. But I would still encourage adults to develop more complicated relationships too, because, you know, you brought up Twain earlier. You know, a book can both be brilliant and toxic. You know, it can both be a work of genius and racist. Those aren't mutually exclusive categories. I think people like to imagine they are, but they're not. And that's okay. It's okay to acknowledge that, and it's okay to find things to admire in Twain, as well as things to criticize. You know, it's and likewise for all of these works. They are art. Art is complicated. Art can also hurt. Art can also damage, and we should acknowledge that too. So it's not that one needs to cancel. You know, it's that one needs to be willing to be reflective about what we are consuming now and what we have consumed in the past, and to think about how maybe what we once loved may be harming others and may have always been harming others, but we just weren't aware of it. You know, like if you're the white person reflecting on this as an adult, do you know how your black or brown classmates felt when you were a kid? What do they think, right? Did you even have any? You know, in America, it's a pretty segregated place. You may not have even had any classmates of color. So, you know, you may not have that context. So you know, which isn't to say throw the book away. You know, it's to say think about what you do with it. Think about how you use it. Think about the questions you raise when you teach it or decide not to teach it.
Let's talk about another aspect of racism in these books, which is erasure. And you talk about William Joyce's fantastic flying books of Mr. Morris Lesmore. So it's the erasure of black actor from places that are, let's say, usually associated with them. So is it a form of racism, or is it a strategy to fight anti-racism?
Well, I think it's an example of what Eduardo Bonilla Silva calls colorblind racism. It's pretending that race doesn't exist. You know, there's a kind of perverse use of this famous line from Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, I hope that one day my children will be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character, which is a wonderful line. You know, it's a poetic line, and it gets misinterpreted as an injunction to not see race. It gets interpreted as a mandate to encourage this in students, and to even espouse this as a belief. But if you don't see race, well, first of all, people do see race. That's just nonsense. You know, from the age of as early as two, children recognize racial differences, and what power it grants them if they're white, or what it takes away if they're not. But then second of all, you know, if you're going to talk about racism, which is a thing, which is exists, you kind of have to talk about race. And so I think pretending that race doesn't exist doesn't help, doesn't equip us to fight racism. And for Joyce's books, he tends to erase characters of color, or if they're there, you know, they're either rare or sort of slightly exotic, or, you know, function as villains. And the erasure is damaging too. I mean, I think one of the biggest harms you can do to somebody is to ignore them, you know, and that's what this does. This says you aren't worthy of representation. You aren't worthy of story. You don't belong here. And it doesn't do it by putting that in print. It does that by omission. You open the book and there's nobody in there who even resembles you or anybody you know. And that really hurts. But again, or I guess I should also say, it hurts as an accretion of examples. And Joyce is just one example, right? There are many, many books that do this. And I should also say that I don't think he's doing it intentionally. Like, I don't think William Joyce himself has any ill intent in these books towards black people or anyone. I really don't. I don't think he's aware of it. I don't think he's aware of the ways in which his own imagination is steeped in a popular culture that perpetuates racist ideas. I don't think he's aware of it. And how could he be in some way? Because, you know, it's like, if you've only ever seen a polluted ocean, that's what an ocean looks like, right? You know, that is the ocean. It's not a polluted ocean. It's an ocean. And so, you know, I think it's a matter of becoming aware. And I just don't think he's aware. But again, I don't think it's out of malice on his part. I really don't. I think the books may have that effect on readers, but I don't think they have it out of some malicious intent on William Joyce's part. And that, I think, is as often as not the case in the way that racism gets perpetuated. It's not that somebody, it's not that Dr. Seuss sort of signs up and says, well, yes, you know, I've always loved the Klan. No, he really didn't. He really didn't at all. But that doesn't mean that he was fully conscious of how his own imagination was steeped in white supremacist imagery. So.
And you talk about this restorative nostalgia and reflective nostalgia in relation to Joyce's aesthetic project. Can you tell us what these two are?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a really helpful way of thinking about how Joyce is a bit complicated. So they come from Svetlana Boym, who is, or was, she passed away a few years ago, one of the sort of preeminent scholars of nostalgia. But restorative nostalgia is the... it's kind of the fascist version of nostalgia, right? It's this longing for this unified, uncomplicated past, to quote her, an enchanted world with clear borders and values. However, as she warns us, only false memories can be totally recalled. That's another quote from her. But I mean, this is the, you know, make America great again. This is make childhood innocent again. You know, this is this kind of longing for this unified and coherent, safe fiction. Whereas reflective nostalgia acknowledges imperfection and ambivalence and pain and complexity, all the things that restorative nostalgia wants you not to think about, according to Boyne. And, you know, for Joyce's own work, visually it is actually quite reflective. You see ruins, you see the effects of time and of history visually. But in terms of its story, white main character, all the books in the library that this main character comes to be the chief librarian of, all white, all the patrons are white, lots and lots of white. And so the vision of this sort of idyllic library that he creates is very much a restorative vision. But again, I don't think because he's consciously aware of doing that. And I think that's maybe why you see in this kind of a mixture of kinds of nostalgia there too. And there's lots of ways of thinking about nostalgia. I've been thinking a lot more about it since since writing this book, I mean, there's anti-colonialist nostalgia. Nostalgia can be radical, you know. There's a scholar of Afro-nostalgia who talks about certain kinds of nostalgia can be restorative and healing. So it's pretty complicated as an idea, and it's not. The useful part of Boehm, and she's very useful, is to remind us that it can point in different directions and can have different ends. And so it's not necessarily bad or good, if you will. It can do lots of different kinds of work. But it's really important because nostalgia tends to be, it tends to direct towards childhood. And so that's why it's really important to think about nostalgia in the context of children's literature. The inventor of the term, a Swiss medical student named Johannes Hofer, it was a diagnosis for soldiers who were suffering this melancholic longing, and what they thought what he thought the solution to that would be to send them home. Send them home. They miss home. A longing for home. But what they discovered is when they sent them there, it didn't really work, because it wasn't a longing for place, it was a longing for time. It was a longing to go back to youth. And so that's why nostalgia is so important when we think about children's literature, because it, for adults, exists in that half-remembered past of our youths. So, yeah.
There is another aspect of racism that you discussed, but it doesn't come from authors. It comes from the publishing industry, and that is the whitewashing of literature. So what is whitewashing? How does whitewashing work in publishing industry? And what are some examples, and what are the consequences of this marketing ploy?
Well, I think as a marketing ploy, it's on the decline, or I'm hopeful that it is. And if people have evidence to the contrary, you should email me and tell me, and I will revise this opinion. But it is a practice that has been common, which is you put a white face on the book, which has a non-white protagonist. Or maybe you show the protagonist on the cover, but from the back, or make the race of the protagonist ambiguous, even though it's not at all ambiguous in the book. And the argument that marketers make is that, and it's a pretty racist argument, that their audience are basically white kids and white people, and they're going to buy the books with the white covers, and that black children don't read as much, or Latinx children don't read as much, or Native American children don't read as much, etc. And that's not true. But that is kind of the marketing argument. We want this to appeal to the widest audience, and so we're going to make these characters white. It's not even demographically true. In the United States, over half of school-aged children are non-white. So, it's wrong in many ways, but that has been an argument used for making these kind of covers. And some authors have pushed back and called attention to it, which was the case at the time I was writing the book. So that's why I put it in there.
How about genre? You call genre the new Jim Crow, as a post-racial way of regulating literary experiences of color people of color. What do you mean by that?
Well, because when people talk about Jim Crow America, they think about segregation as something that separates the races completely. Whites use a white bathroom and blacks use a black bathroom. Whites only signs. But actually, it's more complicated than that. It's really about regulating space. So, a black nanny would be allowed in the white train compartment if she were taking care of the white child, of let's say the mother in that train compartment. So it's actually not completely putting, only you can go here and only this group can go there. It's actually kind of about dividing up space in a way that regulates where you can and cannot be, but in a way that overlaps. But so in the publishing industry, there's a lot more realism, historical fiction, autobiography, verse autobiography about the experiences of people of color than there is fantasy or mystery or science fiction or dystopian fiction. And so that's what I mean by it's a way of regulating that. And there's regulating the experiences of literary experiences of people of color is that there are just fewer examples of diverse genres that they can publish in. And there are certainly examples, you know, of authors who have had this experience where they will write a fantasy book and be told, you know, because they're a black author, well, we already have one author of black fantasy, we don't need another one. Or, you know, or maybe even Asian fantasy, we don't need another one. Or you just, that won't sell. You know, that's not the kind of book that's published. Now, that's been improving lately. You know, there are more examples of that in the last, I want to say, 5 years. And so that's fantastic. You know, there's people like Tracy Dion's Legendborn. There is Donnell Clayton's The Marvelers. You know, there's Kwame Mbalia. There's a lot more in the last 5 years. And there has been in fantasy before that too, but there has been an increased awareness to this gap, and we are starting to see more, for example, you know, fantasy written by members of historically marginalized groups and representing those groups in positive ways too.
And is it I know that you're not a media scholar, so I'm just asking on top of my head, is it something that you've seen in movies as well? Because more recently movies, in fantasy movies, you have more black characters.
Yeah, exactly. And I think those are the exceptions that prove the rule. You know, there have been, and in fact that you would even phrase the question that way, recently there have been. That's true. Recently there's Black Panther and Wakanda Forever and Everything Everywhere All at Once, or even the film adaptation of A Wrinkle in Time had a racially diverse cast that was not present in the original novel. And that's going against a long historical trend. And so I think it is common in movies, and I think the question itself reminds us of how common it is in movies that recently there's been some difference. So, yeah. Or, I mean, the Ms. Marvel, right? The adaptation, the series on Disney Plus, you know, that's the first Muslim superhero starring in a series, like, period, as far as I know, at least of that kind of level of visibility and capitalization and, you know, market saturation. And it was really good too. It was quite different than the comics, the Kamala Khan Ms. Marvel, the series, but it was really well done. I recommend it.
And again, you know, there are some, again, racist people who always have this backlash against even these movies. And the argument is that it's a misinterpretation or alteration of our myths or our histories. But again, it's a lousy excuse. For example, I'm talking about the Black Mermaid, for example, or
right.
Cinderella.
Right.
the angel.
I mean, they're fictional characters.
Yeah.
So
there's no history.
What's the problem, right? And characters and myths can be anybody you want them to. That's kind of the point, that you can imagine an alternate reality, and you can imagine that alternate reality in ways that reflect your beliefs and in ways that help us imagine new ways of living, of being in the world, of interacting with one another. That's what's so, I mean, that's the liberatory potential of fantasy and science fiction, right? Not that liberatory potential is always reached. It is often not reached. But that is the potential of it. Like, let's imagine a different way of living together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I remember there was this play, again, I came across that on Twitter. There was this play based on Jeanne d'Arc, if I'm pronouncing the name correctly, the French. Anyway, so Jeanne d'Arc's character, instead of being a woman, she was a transgender person or a non-binary person, I guess, playing that role. And again, there were a lot of racist people saying, oh, it's a... again, misinterpretation of history or anything, but this is theater. That's the place of imagination, right? Reimagining things. I've seen like a lot of different versions of, for example, Macbeth in modern New York. It is literature, right? It just, as you said, it's It's just trying to show what are the liberatory potentials of plays in a different time.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, Shakespeare is a great example because his work gets adapted in many different ways, in many different time settings, you know. And the plays themselves will include things like cross-dressing. And the plays themselves, when they were performed, had men playing women's roles, you know, right? So yeah, theater is very much a place for adaptation and experimentation. And it has a long history of doing that. And that's why it's fun. But that's why it's fun for maybe for you or for me. You know, I think the people who find this upsetting have a different notion of, well, not just of fun, but of power. I think that the notion of power for them is, you know, art should not raise questions. Performances should not raise questions. The established order is dependent upon our obedience to particular authorities, and we'll decide who those are. It's a way of thinking, and it's an authoritarian way of thinking, but I think that particular style of thought is what makes it difficult to challenge people who espouse those views. I mean, we have to challenge them, but I don't think it makes it hard to convince them, I guess I should say, because like my notion is, yeah, everybody should raise questions, and that's healthy, and we should debate ideas, and maybe we don't all agree, but, you know, how can we all live together despite the fact that some of us have different beliefs? And, oh, you know, I'm glad that you raise these sorts of questions. But for someone of that mindset, that's dangerous. That's fundamentally dangerous. Now, it's not fundamentally dangerous, but it's hard to convince someone who has that kind of authoritarian mindset otherwise. And so that's the challenge, I think. I don't know how to convince enough of those people. I mean, I'm going to make an attempt, but I think that's the challenge.
The last part of your book, there is this afterword, why adults refuse to admit racist content and how the children's books, in the children's books they love. So I guess this is an important part of the book that I know you'd love to talk about more. Can you talk about this part and tell us what are some of the ways that we can diversify children's literature?
Yeah, so the paperback, which if people are looking for a copy, get the paperback. It has an extra afterword to it, and it's cheaper. But yeah, for the paperback, I decided that I would read my hate mail because people had given me all this data, and I thought, well, I should use the data. And by hate mail, I mean both actual emails I received. I mean, you know, comments on Twitter. I mean, direct messages across Facebook from people I don't know. And then I mean also comments on media articles where I'm quoted or the book is profiled. And you know, I thought, well, this is a really useful bit of information that these people have been generous enough to deliver. And so what are some of the patterns that we see here? And I'm drawing inspiration from the scholar Gloria Wecker, who did this an exhibit featuring it was critical of the character Zwarte Piet, or Black Piet, who is the racist caricature who's an assistant to Santa Claus in Dutch culture. But anyway, I thought, well, that's a really good idea. And unlike her, you know, she's an Afro-Surinamese woman. I am not. And so, you know, for her, reading all that, she said, was like taking an undiluted dose of poison. And for me, reading all this wasn't, because there is no N-word for white people. Like, there's nothing historically or culturally or in the language that you can say that would hurt me in that way. It's just the whole system is structured to keep me safe. And so I thought, well, you know what? Then that's the reason I should look at this. But long story short, what really interested me about that was why people resisted analysis. And you know, I think a lot of it has to do with nostalgia, and a lot of it has to do with a sense of feeling threatened. Because a lot of these responses were deeply emotional, you know. They were angry. And they don't know me, right? I mean, I haven't wronged them in any way, but they're super angry. So why are they so angry? And I think it comes back to that feeling personally hurt that something they love might cause harm, because then that makes them feel guilty. And I think that is why there are laws being passed right now in the United States, see Florida, see Oklahoma, and see many other states, you know, that are forbidding the teaching of history in any ways that might make students, read here, white students, uncomfortable. People don't like to be made uncomfortable. And the conservatives understand that, because if you feel discomfort and you realize there's injustice, well, you have to do something, don't you? And they recognize that when people, you know, when young children recognize injustice, they want to do something. But anyway, that's the first half of the question, and this is probably too long. So if anybody is still listening to this podcast, I apologize for being so loquacious. I hope you have brewed yourself a nice cup of tea or coffee to get through these long answers. But the second half is, the afterword to the conclusion to the original book, which is a manifesto of, you know, what we should do, because I didn't want to end a book which diagnoses a problem and just say, well, there's the problem. I wanted to end the book and point in different ways that people could help. And there's a lot of advice in that. But I mean, I think, you know, read the books, buy the books, give them as gifts. If you're a teacher, assign the books. And everyone needs to read diverse children's books, not just members of those groups. Members of those groups need them because they need to feel that they deserve books, that they are important, that their experiences, that their lives have meaning, that they matter, that they have potential. But everyone needs to read them because, you know, white kids shouldn't grow up thinking they're the center of the universe. That's dangerous. That's just dangerous, you know? So everyone needs them. Everyone needs to read them. And adults too. Adults too. But certainly children. And, you know, just as an example, as a teacher, something that I do and something that I learned from the scholar and a friend of mine, Ebony Elizabeth Thomas, is you can just diversify your course. Like, it doesn't have to be multicultural children's literature to teach the class that way. The first time I taught multicultural children's literature, I contacted her and some other friends to say, hey, you know, I'm teaching this for the first time. I know you teach this. Do you have any advice or tips or text you think I should assign? And she said, well, you know, I teach my literature for children class at the college level as a multicultural children's literature class. And just a light bulb went off over my head when she said that, because of course my literature for children class had diverse voices, and it always has, but I didn't think of turning up the intensity on that. You know, I didn't think of explicitly foregrounding that until she told me. I felt some kind of, I guess, like unconscious loyalty to literary canons, and that everyone must read Alice in Wonderland or something, which I think everyone must read, but not necessarily in the introduction to literature for children. You should maybe know about it, but there's so many other books that you can read. And so I think part of this is like decolonizing your own imagination, you know, recognizing your own assumptions about what is and isn't important. And so grateful to Ebony for that insight. And that's what I do now. You know, I teach that class as really a version of a multicultural children's literature class. I also teach multicultural children's literature, where all of the books are by minoritized authors. But my main children's literature class is, you know, mostly books by non-white writers. So yes, many things we can do.
Is there any particular author you have in mind who is actively doing these things? For example, authors who previously wrote books which were racist and they didn't know because it was a product of the time, they tried to write a foreword to their book saying that I lived in a time where these stereotypes were common. But is there any author you have in mind particularly that is trying to diversify these books?
Well, I mean, all of them. I mean, I guess there's two answers. I mean, one is that literally all the writers of minoritized backgrounds, whether it's Donnell Clayton or Zeta Elliott or Melinda Lowe or Christopher Myers or Lisa Yee or Sherry Dimeline or Dan Santat or Min Lay or Meg Medina or Daniel Jose Older. I mean, all of the people who are writing stories, some of them fantasy stories, some of them realistic stories, some of them poetry, some of them historical fiction, but, you know, drawing upon some of their lived experience, sort of own voices books, if you will, books about diverse characters who reflect that diverse background. So, I mean, literally all of those people. But then if you're thinking about white authors, you know, people with who historically have had much more power and still do have much more power in the publishing industry, I think I'd single out Rick Riordan, who's probably best known as the author of the Percy Jackson series. But he has a whole Rick Riordan Presents imprint where he features authors writing stories inspired by the mythologies and folklore of their cultures. So Kwame Mbalia's Tristan Strong books, G.C. Cervantes' Stormrunner trilogy, Roshani Choksi's Pandava series. So basically what his Percy Jackson books do for Greek and Roman myths, these books do for, you know, African and African-American folklore, Mayan mythology, Hindu stories, and there are many others beside these. But yeah, I mean, I guess I would single him out as a white person who is using his power to elevate the voices of those who have not been heard. But yeah, and then literally all of the people who have been, you know, fighting for their place at the table for all these years and who are writing these stories based on their own experience, all of them. So that's a long list, and I only offered just the tiniest sliver of that. So,
Dr. Philip Nell, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us on New Books Network.
No, thanks for having me. I hope my answers weren't too long, but if they were,
not at all.
maybe you can edit that in post, as they say.
Not at all. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me, and yeah, have a good day.